Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nathan Wessler of the ACLU, who explains why his group is challenging the Obama administration's targeted killing program that has used unmanned drone aircraft to kill three U.S. citizens in Yemen. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who talks about the controversy surrounding Rush Limbaugh's attack on law student Sandra Fluck and Now's campaign to take the right-wing talk show host off the air. And Keisha Gaskins of the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses the challenges underway to laws enacted by Republican governors in 12 states designed to suppress voter participation. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since entering the White House, Barack Obama has embraced a new generation of high-tech warfare and drone strikes, covert actions, and targeted killings of Islamic insurgents, including American citizens. In 3 years, the Obama administration carried out 239 secret drone strikes, five times the number approved by President George W. Bush. According to Foreign Policy magazine, the covert program has created a high level of resentment in Pakistan and helped undermine the civilian rule of President Asif Ali Zardari. President Obama publicly defends the strategy of drone strikes in Pakistan, Libya, and Yemen as, quote, very precise precision attacks against al-Qaeda and its affiliates. In recent months, an increased number of drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal area near the Afghan border led General Parvez Kayani, head of the Pakistan Army, to complain that drone attacks have been carelessly and callously targeted with complete disregard to human life. Fearing more criticism from Pakistan, the White House undertook a full review of their use of drones. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates warned that the angry Pakistani army could block U.S. supplies headed for Afghanistan. Diplomatic officials also worried about growing instability that could topple Pakistan's civilian government, a major concern in a country with a nuclear arsenal and a population of 180 million. Ultimately, President Obama sided with the CIA and allowed the drone strikes to continue. Meanwhile, drone attacks inside Pakistan have eroded public support for the military's assault on Islamic militants inside the tribal areas. And some retired U.S. military officials warn that drones and commando raids are no substitute for the difficult process of helping local leaders to marginalize militants. A growing number of right-wing activists are turning off Fox News, run by longtime Republican strategist Roger Ailes. Some activists charge that Fox is playing favorites in the Republican primary campaign and giving too much airtime to establishment figures like former Bush advisor Karl Rove, who supports candidate Mitt Romney. Grumbling among activists was on display at the recent Conservative Political Action Conference, where some wore Bring Back Beck buttons. Glenn Beck was forced out of his primetime show on Fox last year when Fox chief Roger Ailes was said to be trying to tone down commentary aligning the network with the more radical right elements of the Tea Party movement. But the transformation of Fox News from a conservative propaganda machine into a serious news outlet remains a distant mirage. Fox News continues to reinforce Republican Party orthodoxy and ideology on issues ranging from abortion and immigration to vehement opposition to gay marriage. In a crude attempt to maintain a facade of fairness and balance, Fox skillfully employs token pseudo-liberal pundits like Bob Beckel and Juan Williams, who echo the Fox News cultural agenda, decrying the secular world's so-called war on Christmas and promoting opposition to the proposed Muslim Cultural Center blocks away from Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan. In December of 2010, Bob Beckel called for the assassination of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, declaring that, quote, a dead man can't leak stuff. In an effort to suppress undercover video investigations that expose the abuse of animals on factory farms, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad signed into law what is commonly known as the Ag Gag Bill on March 8th. This bill would make it illegal for anyone to film on a farm without the farm owner's knowledge. Mercy for Animals Executive Director Nathan Runkel says that Governor Branstad, by signing this bill, has created a safe haven for animal abuse and other criminal activity in the state. Runkel maintains that consumers have a right to know how their food is being produced and how animals on modern farms are treated so they can make informed choices. However, Governor Branstad maintains that gaining access to property under false pretenses is a serious offense and that farmers deserve protection. Nathan Runkel defends undercover investigations organized by Mercy for Animals and other groups because without them, he says, the industry will not effectively police itself. Runkel also asserts that the exposés have led to the convictions of animal abusers, the closure of particularly corrupt facilities, and landmark reforms which protect animals and the environment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As the U.S. military and intelligence agencies have increased their use of unmanned, weaponized drone aircraft to kill suspected terrorists abroad, the Obama administration's decision to assassinate U.S. citizens has provoked alarm and many questions from civil liberties advocates and the news media. On September 30, 2011, the CIA and the military's Joint Special Operations Command launched missiles from a drone over Yemen, killing alleged terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen born in New Mexico, and Samir Khan, also a U.S. citizen. Al-Awlaki's son, a 16-year-old U.S. citizen born in Colorado, was killed 2 weeks later in another U.S. drone attack in Yemen. In response to the killing of three American citizens by U.S. drones, the American Civil Liberties Union submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA, Department of Defense, and Department of Justice, seeking information about the targeted killing program. When the Obama administration refused to confirm or deny the existence of the program, the ACLU filed a lawsuit on February 1st, demanding that the government release legal memos, provide the evidentiary basis for the decision to kill the three U.S. citizens, including the process by which the administration adds Americans to secret government kill lists. Although the government maintains that the targeted killing program is a national security secret that cannot be publicly acknowledged, many U.S. officials, including President Obama, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, and Attorney General Eric Holder, have confirmed its existence in speeches and press interviews. Your reporter spoke with Nathan Wessler, National Security Fellow with the ACLU's National Security Project, who explains why his group is challenging the legality of the government assassination program that appears to have no oversight or judicial review.
This targeted killing program is certainly bubbled up into the public consciousness in this country over the last few years as issues around relations with Pakistan and backlash against the program there have arisen, and other questions of civilian casualties and the wisdom of the program. But really, it's been slingshotted into the public consciousness in the last few months around the issue of the targeted killing of United States citizens. Last September, two U.S. citizens were killed in a drone strike in Yemen. Anwar al-Awlaki, who was apparently on these United States kill lists, and then another person, Samir Khan, another U.S. citizen, who apparently was not on a kill list and was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then 2 weeks later, the United States killed a 16-year-old U.S. citizen. His name was Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. He's the son of Anwar al-Awlaki. Killed in a separate drone strike, apparently targeting another person, but failing to protect his life. And so these three killings of U.S. citizens in the last few months have really raised serious questions about the scope of this authority to target and kill people around the world and the due process protections that citizens have when they're put on one of these kill lists and then targeted for death.
Tell us about the ACLU's Freedom of Information Act request for the legal justification for these assassinations, particularly of the U.S. citizens who've been killed recently.
Sure. So, there's been a lot reported in the press about the legal basis for these targeted killings and about the actual factual circumstances of them. But the government has said very little on the record about it. They've certainly acknowledged that a targeted killing program exists in a couple instances. But we know that there is a legal memo written by the Department of Justice and their Office of Legal Counsel that set out in great detail, about a 50-page memo, the New York Times reported, setting out the legal rationales that they claimed allowed them to target and kill U.S. citizens, and specifically Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, we can't for the life of us think of a good reason for the government not to release the legal justifications for killing U.S. citizens to the public. So we have filed a Freedom of Information Act request and now a lawsuit to enforce that request, seeking that memo, as well as records about the factual basis for targeting and killing Anwar al-Awlaki and the facts surrounding the killing of the two other U.S. citizens. Now, in response to that request, we sent the request to the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Incredibly, the Department of Justice and the CIA responded by refusing to confirm or deny whether they have any records, because they won't confirm or deny whether the CIA even has a targeted killing program. Now, that's at this point, it's just absurd for them to be taking that position. You know, they're arguing that whether or not there's a targeted killing program run by the CIA is itself a state secret that they can't discuss in any way. But if that's if that program is a secret, you know, at this point it has to be just the worst kept secret in the entire world.
Nathan, what are the troubling repercussions of this program in terms of other nations adopting a similar assassination program against political or military actors that they deem to be enemies of their state? I mean, you know, we could have Russia, China, India, Pakistan, Iran, a whole range of nations could invoke the United States precedent here in assassinating people with their own drones or assassination teams, and cite Washington's behavior here as the standard for their own behavior.
Yeah, I think that's a very serious concern. I mean, there are now dozens of countries who either currently have drone technology or will soon have it, giving them the, you know, the technological ability to do what the United States has been doing. And it will be very hard for the United States to argue that there need to be serious limits on other countries' authorities and powers to carry out these kind of targeted killing programs. I mean, we've seen in other contexts how powers claimed by the United States really affect its ability to effectively criticize other governments. Under the Bush administration, when there was a torture policy or when some of the worst detention policies were in place, you know, it was very hard for the United States to stand up on the international stage with any credibility and criticize the worst practices of some of the dictatorships of the world. So I think it's a very serious concern. And the legal limits that the United States has articulated for itself are certainly broad enough that you could imagine a number of countries carrying out targeted killings in across borders all over the place. And someday, maybe we'd see it, inside our borders too, which is a discomforting thought. But it's not one that's by any means ruled out under the legal authorities as they've been explained.
That was Nathan Wessler, National Security Fellow with the ACLU's National Security Project. Find more information about the ACLU's challenge to the government's targeted killing program on our website at btlonline.org. On his February 29th nationally syndicated radio program, Rush Limbaugh attacked a female law student named Sandra Fluck, who had volunteered to testify before a congressional committee about the need for birth control to be covered under the Affordable Care Act. House Oversight and Government Reform Committee Chair Daryl Issa had earlier prevented Fluck from testifying before his committee because, he said, the focus of the hearing was not on women's health, but on religious persecution. In his broadcast, Limbaugh called Fluck a slut and a prostitute, then followed up that with a demand that she videotape herself having sex and post it on the Internet. The attack set off an immediate call by outraged women and men for advertisers to drop their support for his three-hour daily show. On March 12th, Think Progress reported that 140 advertisers, including dozens of major national corporations, had requested their ads no longer air on Limbaugh's program. LifeLock and Lear Financial are among the companies continuing to stand by Limbaugh. Now, the National Organization for Women has called on Premier Networks, the largest radio syndication company in the U.S. and a wholly owned subsidiary of Clear Channel Communications, to fire Rush Limbaugh. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with now President Terry O'Neill about the controversy and what her organization is doing to increase the pressure on Limbaugh's advertisers and stations to drop the conservative talk show.
said that the words slut and prostitute are not the problem with what he said. His first diatribe against Sandra Fluck was very long and involved an extraordinary, basically, fantasy, a sexual fantasy about her sex life. He insisted that she was having so much sex that she needed all the birth control. She needed more and more and more birth control, which, hello, that's not how birth control works. But he said she was having so much sex he couldn't believe she could still walk. And by the way, it's clearly defamatory. I don't know if she intends to file a lawsuit against him, but I think that he absolutely crossed the line. She's a private figure. She's not a public figure. And so it wasn't the slut word and the prostitute word. It was the whole diatribe against her when her only crime was to go to the United States Congress to offer testimony about the importance of birth control as basic health care, preventive health care for young women. It now has a media hall of shame. We call out people in the media when they launch misogynistic attacks on women who are in the public spheres. And when Rush Limbaugh attacked Sandra Fluck, we called that out on our media hall of shame and encouraged our activists to contact a Clear Channel and encourage Clear Channel to dump him, take him off the air, because we felt that he should be fired. There followed 2 days by Rush Limbaugh on his radio show where he doubled down against Sandra Fluck. The second radio show was the one where I believe he engaged in the sexual fantasy about being able to watch her having sex on a video. He did it again the next day. So really, 3 solid days, 3 hours a day, he was really viciously attacking Sandra Fluck. And since then, we have renewed our call for Clear Channel to fire him. I know that Crystal Ball from Northern Virginia put up a website called boycottrush.org. Then there's another website called stoprush.org. So there are a number of organizations that are mobilizing. So it's up to 140 advertisers, and I think the next wave is going to be the stations. Again, I have said publicly on a number of occasions that the stations need to drop him. And I believe that that will continue to happen. This thing is not going to end. It is continuing to roll along. In fact, we are going to be speaking with Media Matters, a nonprofit organization that has followed Russia's very shameful history of attacking women, people of color, immigrants, you name it, LGBT people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Media Matters has been really great at tracking his history of bigotry on the air, and we are working with them to continue to insist that Rush Limbaugh does not belong on the air.
Terry O'Neill, it was reported on March 12th that without explanation, Premier Networks, which is the wholly owned subsidiary of Clear Channel, told its affiliate radio stations that they are suspending national advertising for 2 weeks. These spots are how Premier makes its money from Limbaugh's show and other shows it syndicates. Some stations are running free public service announcements in those slots.
That's a significant dent in the profitability of that show, but it's not enough. And as long as Clear Channel is deciding to stand by their man, the individual stations need to drop him. So far, only 2 out of 600-odd stations have dropped him. But my expectation is that you'll begin to see more and more as pressure begins to build on those stations to dump him. I think the reality is the stations have not personally felt a lot of pressure. I think that the activists around the country are still right now focused on advertisers. And you can see that because I guess it was a few days ago it was only 50 and now it's up to 140.
So what are NOW's grassroots activists doing to try to get Rush off the air?
We are still working on the plan of how we're going to roll all this out. But I will tell you that NOW chapters are already energized and women are already gearing up and going after those stations.
Can you address the argument that some people say Rush Limbaugh is a talk show host? This kind of outrageous talk is par for the course and what listeners should expect, and he has a First Amendment right to say it?
Rush Limbaugh does not have a First Amendment right to be on the radio. He has a First Amendment right not to be prosecuted by the government for what he says. He does not have a First Amendment right to be carried by Clear Channel. He doesn't have a First Amendment right to be supported by advertisers. Obviously, he has a right to free speech, but he does not have a right to defame Sandra Fluck. That's why we have defamation laws in this country. Libel and slander is something that is wrong, and there is no First Amendment right to commit libel and slander, which I believe is what he did. Now, I don't know that he's going to be sued for it, But by the way, he has decided to go after me personally for some of the remarks that I made about Rush. He seems to believe that it is to his benefit to keep this issue going. And as long as he decides it's to his benefit, he is going to be spewing vile statements and ugly comments wherever he thinks he can spew them. But from my point of view, he has crossed a line, and he needs to be off the air.
That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the Rush Limbaugh controversy on our website at btlonline.org. Since the midterm elections of 2010, when Republican Party majorities took control over many state legislatures and governor seats, the nation has seen a flood of bills restricting access to voting, with the imposition of onerous ID laws, elimination of voter registration programs, and curtailment of early voting schedules. Although the rationale presented for the passage of these laws is to prevent voter fraud, there is little or no evidence that voter fraud has been a problem in any state or federal election over the past decade. The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division announced on March 12th that it will block Texas from implementing a new law requiring voters to present photo identification at the polls, declaring that the new requirement would disproportionately disenfranchise minority voters in the state. That decision came on the same day a Wisconsin judge struck down another controversial GOP-backed voter ID law in Wisconsin. The Justice Department had acted in December to block a similar ID law in South Carolina. The American Legislative Exchange Council, financed by some of America's largest corporations, has helped draft many of the restrictive voting bills that have passed in 12 states. Under these laws, an estimated 5 million, mostly low-income, minority, and young voters, who often vote for Democrats, could lose their right to vote. Your reporter spoke with Keisha Gaskins, senior counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses the challenges underway to new election laws, which critics say have been enacted to suppress voter participation for partisan advantage.
What we've seen, particularly since the beginning of the 2011 legislative session, is a spate of restrictive voter laws. And so we've seen laws to restrict early voting days and absentee voting, to restrict community-based voter registration. And the most prolific sort of bucket of laws certainly has been restrictions on acceptable voter IDs at the polls. And it just the absurdity of some of these laws and the impact and how we're seeing people be affected. You know, we're seeing it over and over again. We're seeing it in Texas. We're seeing it in South Carolina. We're seeing it in Florida, Kansas, Tennessee, Wisconsin. And it's still moving. We're seeing new legislation introduced in states every day. And looks like we're going to see some passage in some states that give us some real grave concerns.
Tell us a little bit about the motivation here, because the Republican majorities that have pushed these laws forward in large part have done so on the basis of what they say is to stop voter fraud. But I know that there are many studies which indicate voting fraud really is not a huge issue or any issue at all, state to state or nationally. But maybe you can give us your analysis of the drive behind the move to put obstacles in front of voters, but also the rationale about voting fraud.
You know, I'm always loath to try and impute motives to others. What I can say is that we know that there's 11% of American eligible voters who don't have government-issued voter ID. And any of these laws that are put in place that restrict access, make it more difficult, make it harder and harder for these Americans to get to the polls. And as we are all aware, a big part of the justification for imposing all these laws and restrictions on voting has been voter fraud. You know, and I think we need to be very clear. When we talk about voter fraud, we mean someone who votes knowing they're not supposed to be voting. And I'm not trying to be cute or semantic here, but I think what you find is that proponents of these laws, using examples of errors in voter registration lists, people voting with bad information, problems arising out of insufficient funding, bad poll worker training, all in this giant bucket of election problems, and then they propose voter ID as a solution. And, of course, it's a solution in search of a problem. There simply is no evidence that there is widespread voter fraud out there. And, in fact, the only type of voter fraud that most of these laws address is voter impersonation. And that's the act of somebody going to the polls and pretending they're somebody else. And we have looked long and hard to try and find examples of this, to try and find when this has actually happened, and we simply can't find it. And our evidence shows us you're more likely to be struck and killed by lightning than we are able to find substantiated cases of voter impersonation in any given state in the country. So it's really difficult to justify these laws that we calculate could affect up to 5 million voters in the next election cycle.
Keisha, tell our listeners a bit about what power the Obama administration's Justice Department here has to challenge some of these laws on the basis of these bills and voter ID laws disproportionately affecting minority voters, African Americans and Latinos.
Sure. There are sort of two-in-one sort of tools available to the Justice Department, particularly when dealing with minority voting rights. They both come within the province of the Voting Rights, 1965 Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the section where certain jurisdictions must obtain approval or preclearance from the federal government before their laws can be put in place. And so those are states like Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, all of which have enacted severe restrictions on voting, and most of which submitted to the Department of Justice for preclearance. In the states of South Carolina and Texas, the Justice Department refused to preclear those cases, and now both those cases are in district court in Washington, D.C. Outside of the particular jurisdictions that have a particular history of discrimination, to bring them within the jurisdiction is Section 5. There's also Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and that applies to every state in the country. And where it can be shown that a voting law or rule was put into place that has the particular effect of diluting the vote of populations, minority populations that are protected under the Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department, again, may step in and act in any of those cases in any jurisdiction.
That was Keisha Gaskins, Senior Counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Learn more about the challenges to new restrictive election laws on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.